Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Suk-Yong Kim, Professor of Theatre and Director of the Center for Performance Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, who'll be talking about her book, K-Pop Live, Fans, Idols, and Multimedia Performance, which was published last year, 2018, by Stanford University Press. K-pop very likely needs no introduction to listeners of this podcast, or indeed anyone else interested in pop culture, as this multimedia phenomenon has been a growing presence in Asia and around the world for many years now. As our guest today observes, K-pop is an animal that thrives on excess, end quote, as larger-than-life stars give amazing vocal and dance performances, which are promoted via a dizzying array of multimedia platforms in an ever-transforming range of styles, fashions, and genres. All in all, it's pretty hard to ignore K-pop. And as Suk-Yong Kim makes clear, we certainly shouldn't be ignoring it, as it provides such a revealing window into all manner of critically important subjects, from people's interactions with technology versus in-person interaction, to neoliberal economics, Asian and geopolitical entanglements across the world, and the most cutting-edge interfaces between artistic performance and new tech, from live chat to holograms. K-pop Live takes us deep into this dazzling world, tracing the technological, economic, and political conditions which have underlain K-pop's emergence and success, teasing out the entangled threads of music, dance, video, social media, and commerce which make up the wider K-pop tapestry, and even arguing in the process for new understandings of what the K in K-pop should be seen to stand for. Kim's work is based on ethnographic research at gigs and conventions, interviews with industry players, and one gets the feeling from reading this really engaging and entertaining book, no small amount of embodied induction as a fan and fascinated observer of K-pop herself. In any case, though, to hear more about how deep this fandom goes and many other matters, I'll say Suk-Yong Kim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to appear. I have to say I hugely enjoyed this book and learned a tremendous amount from it. Suk-Yong, perhaps I could begin by asking you a bit about yourself and your background and how you came to focus on K-pop specifically. I think some of your earlier work was about North Korea and other subjects. So could you give us a bit of a picture of how this this topic came into your life?
Sure. You know, my past books were on North Korean state-produced propaganda performances. And, you know, those are quote-unquote high-budget shows that were enjoying the full-fledged state support from North Korea, intended to kind of educate and organize society. I mean, culture in North Korea has a place that is hard for us to imagine, which is really the way the future looks like. You know, it is a kind of mechanism through which people kind of envision better future. So, you know, while I was researching on North Korea, many people asked, I mean, how is our society different? And, you know, how would you characterize what North Korean state is doing to their state as being different from how our hyper-commercial culture in so-called Western world is doing to the minds of our young people? So this question really made me think about Yeah, how can I respond to this rather challenging question? And this was a time when K-pop was landing in the U.S. Social media in a very visible way. In 2012, Psy's Gangnam Style hit YouTube and social media in a very conspicuous way. I mean, you could not spend a day avoiding Gangnam Style, you know, listening to it or hearing about it. And, you know, these two kind of trend of kind of thoughts came together and made me really want to address the question that puzzled me, right? I mean, how are media choices that are offered to us really a choice? And how do we actually connect to each other and build a community while also being manipulated by broader forces behind it? So I started really looking into the media network you know, contents like K-pop's dissemination and who are the players behind it and whether that makes or breaks human connections, you know, that we used to really have through live interaction. And I guess one thing that really puzzled me was how K-pop is ubiquitous online, right? Its natural habitat is YouTube, Twitter, social media networks, all these mediated human interactions, whereas it was promoting itself as live music. I mean, as paradoxical as it sounds, there's a lot of simulations of live interactions and real genuine connections that are fostered in K-pop industry. So that's why I decided to particularly focus on the meaning of liveness in K-pop industry.
Right, right. No, that makes sense as a kind of trajectory. But I just wonder, at the beginning, kind of pre your interest in North Korean official culture and so on, did you come at that from a direction of interest in politics and cultural promotion, or was it performance per se that had been your initial focus kind of in your doctoral studies and so on?
Yeah, great question. I actually have a doctoral degree in Russian and Slavic studies.
Oh, okay.
And that was really the starting point. I went to Moscow to study Russian language and literature in 91 and 92. And there I encountered North Korean students, and they fascinated me. You know, our preconceived notions of North Koreans are that they're really clandestine and secretive and are ignorant of outside world, but these were really lively, well-educated students that I became friends with. And although I wrote my dissertation on Slavic folklore, I mean, thoughts about North Koreans always stayed with me and fascinated me. So I guess the kind of political potential of live storytelling and performance and folklore migrated into studying North Korean state propaganda. And, you know, in society like North Korea, you cannot really segregate politics and performance, right? I mean, politics is performance and performance is politics. It's so intertwined in a way that it's hard to kind of think of political theater as a particular brand of theater. All theater is political and vice versa. So,
Well, I think you, the kind of theatricality of, certainly historically Soviet official culture and other state socialist regimes or political arrangements that have a very strong official cultural output, that looks like something very unique. But I think what you show in this book is that question of how different are we, or how different are our set societies that are set up quite differently, and the differences are actually somewhat more nuanced than a big clash between socialist countries or historically socialist countries like the Soviet Union and North Korea and what is going on in South Korea. Also, in terms of K-pop itself, at what point did that kind of come into your life as a phenomenon? You mentioned Gangnam Style being a sort of pivotal moment of the global emergence, but in Korea, were you always a fan of the popular music scene, or how does it fit within your own personal music tastes?
Right. So my closet dream is to become a singer. Maybe it's too late or maybe not.
No.
As a teenager growing up in South Korea in the 70s and 80s, I never skipped the top of the chart music shows on TV. I watched all the variety shows that I could, which featured these singers. But, you know, I mean, Korean music really made it big until the new millennium. And as a college professor, I would start seeing these subtle changes on campus. I came to the States in 1996. And back then, people didn't even know that South Korea had its own pop music, right? Nobody bothered to ask. Nobody cared. And after the first decade of new millennium, I started seeing my students kind of asking me questions about certain K-pop idols, or, you know, some random student would pass by wearing some K-pop idol t-shirt. And I thought, this is no longer a kind of, you know, youth subculture, and it's right on the cusp of entering something major. And it just really piqued my curiosity as to what is driving this particular transition. And just in daily life, I started seeing more and more of K-pop idols just surfacing in mainstream as well as, live tour circuits. So I think all of those kind of trickled down into my research and kind of kept me going.
Yeah, well, it comes through very clearly the really sincere interest and passion for this, I think. And I love your voice throughout the book, really, constantly moving between what is, as you mentioned, perhaps a lifelong ambition or a musical dream, but also, the realities of being a researcher. And I noticed that it's still the case that your Twitter handle is Dr. Ajuma, a sort of moniker you came up with in connection with doing some of this research. As a person who is not the kind of teenage and 20-year-old classic fan of K-pop, could you say a bit more about how you actually did the research, what the kind of activities you engaged in were to get into this K-pop scene?
Of course. First, you have to digest a multitude of online contents regarding K-pop. And I don't just mean by K-pop idols' musical performance, right, which is just the starting point of a much broader network of media contents, fan reaction videos, cover dance, and other variety shows, and both fan and idol generated media contents just proliferate, right? And all the retweets and endless, feed of tweets. I mean, so it's pretty busy just catching up with that. But then I think in order to really understand K-pop's global reach, I mean, you really have to understand the fans, and that's a very difficult job. And I think I have just started to scratch the surface, and I really hope that future generation of scholars would research K-pop fandom more systematically and more in depth, because it's one of the hardest kind of research areas regarding K-pop studies. But what I did with my limited mobility and time was to really kind of eavesdrop on their conversation online as well as offline, and try to kind of enter unique fan space that kind of emerges in concerts or particular fan culture. And, you know, having young college students as my constant conversation partner really helps. They know so much more than I do, because I personally cannot be on Twitter or, in front of my screen 24/7 like this Generation Z can. So I try to really learn from my students as much as I can. And I accepted every single teaching opportunities in Korea to be there and kind of feel the vibe, and also to see how state really uses this cyber nationalism to kind of ride on K-pop's popularity. So I really fall short on my efforts in terms of fan studies. And I think, there are many talented young scholars who are going to do deep research into this in the future.
Well, I this is even that notwithstanding, this is a fantastic kind of survey of the different worlds of fandom, and that really leads us quite neatly, I think, into the book, the body of the book itself. And you begin the introduction taking us straight into the action, really, at an EXOR concert, and you give us a really vivid picture of your own position in relation to the performance that's kind of going on in front of you, and the feeling of liveness, which you've already alluded to, which is something that the book as a whole seeks to theorize, I think. So could you say something about what this idea of liveness is, and what is it you're seeking to understand under this term of liveness?
Sure. I know it's such a abstract concept, but what fascinated me about liveness is that it has so many kind of secondary or derivative meanings that are actually more essential than the kind of primary meaning of live, which often translates into real-time coexistence between fans and stars, performers and spectators. So this co-present in time and space is just one starting point to think about how we exist as subjects in this mediatized world, right? What are the technological implications to make somebody feel that we are having a live interaction, although we're not in the same time or space zone? So the book kind of divides two big kind of trend of thought regarding liveness, which is to look at the technological networks to make us feel that we're part of the live interaction. But I guess that's just an entry point into thinking about much more significant dimension of liveness, which is how do we feel in this world that we are actually having a meaningful connection to other? And how are communities built in this mediatized world? How do we really feel the sense of being alive? And those are really existential questions, if you think about it. And it's a hard question to answer. So, you know, in terms of K-pop, K-pop's liveness, I think what's just most astonishing about K-pop as a cultural phenomenon is its global fandom. And, you know, one of the main arguments I make about fans is that they don't see K-pop just as consumer culture. They see it as a kind of phenomenon, right? That they're inherently part of. They are the makers of this phenomenon, and idols perhaps is just a medium to mitigate its progress. So it's quite astonishing to see how something like K-pop can be both just, you know, the most dazzling example of consumerist culture of today, but at the same time, giving fans a feeling of being alive by joining a community that they can truly connect to, although they have never seen each other. So it's both this kind of heightened consumerist culture, at the same time, truly impactful cultural movement.
And without getting sort of too deep into the I guess anthropological weeds, if you like, the book's insights into who we are as subjects when we are navigating this constant tension between what you call, I think, a yearning for a sense of belonging and aliveness, even amidst the fragmentation and isolation which the technology that we use to try to generate that very sense of connection is also distancing us. It's also kind of keeping us, something that is also a function of being quite far apart in physical space. And I think that is it's a tremendous kind of contribution of the book that it helps us to understand how modern or postmodern subjects are negotiating this. But another sort of really compelling dimension is your broader sort of dissection of K-pop. And I mentioned this in my introduction there, but the K of K-pop, you kind of give a really fascinating expansion of what that K might stand for. We'll come perhaps to the Korea aspect in a moment, but what about the other kind of ways in which you understand K? What else could it stand for in this world?
Oh, yes. I had so much fun writing that section because K could stand not only for Korea, but, you know, many other things to really capture K-pop's uniqueness. You know, one definition I use is that K-pop stands for kaleidoscopic pop, meaning that it is not just music, it is not just dance, but it is total multimedia performance. So that kind of multimedia aspect is captured in kaleidoscopic pop. At times, I use it as Kleenex pop, which stands for how K-pop aims for fast production and fast consumption. So just like, you know, Kleenex tissue that you use once and throw away. I mean, most of K-pop music is, you know, just circulating for a couple of weeks and then they disappear. So
right.
It's a hype. 101,
the boy band that appears on the front cover of the book don't even exist anymore, right? Or they've officially disbanded. So I think that kind of illustrates that quite well.
Oh, sadly, yes, because I was a huge fan and I intentionally put 101 on the cover image because I knew that the band would be disbanded in a year and a half.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, and sometimes I use K-pop as catch-up pop, meaning that, you know, it has a kind of formulaic kind of outcome. It has predictable taste, somewhat predictable production process, you know, just like mass-produced consumerist products. So it kind of, you know, goes back and forth between all those registers of K.
No, I think that's it's a great kind of way of exploring the many multifaceted dimensions of the musical kind of world and performative world that you explore here. But perhaps we'll return to the very most obvious and most commonly used K, the Korean dimension. What about the Koreanness of this music? And specifically, I suppose, one thing that I really found incredibly revealing and insightful in this introduction too is your exploration of this notion of hung, the kind of untranslatable term that perhaps it encodes certain aspects of warmth and inclusivity, but also spontaneity and excitement and many of the things which you see as being inherently important to K-pop and the Korean dimension of it. Could you say a bit more about that and the Korean identity behind the music?
Right. So, you know, that Korean aspect of K-pop was really difficult to tackle because, I mean, you don't want to essentialize, you know, about what a country is, not to mention Korea, right? But at the same time, I mean, as somebody who grew up in Korea and spent formative years in that country and was a South Korean for the most of, you know, one's life, I cannot help but to notice how Koreans just love singing. The spontaneous gathering of people will always end up in some kind of singing and having fun. And sadly enough, due to Korea's modern history, which has been marred by colonialization and division and war and separation, this aspect of the spontaneous joy that Koreans have when they gather as community has been less studied and has been kind of overshadowed by the notion of han, which is this grief, another untranslatable term, right? So I kind of thought that K-pop's kind of global popularity is a very good occasion to bring light this very unique notion of hung, which is embedded in this kind of almost ritualistic participation of communal joy and, you know, that erasure between performer and spectator, that we all come together to be a part of this kind of, you know, joyful moment, mostly through singing and sometimes dancing. But, you know, for the most part, Koreans sing when they drink and gather as community. So I felt like, you know, one thing that is truly kind of unique to K-pop is that it is, yes, a performance built in discipline. yes, it is a difficult industry to kind of, you know, sustain and survive. But at the same time, I think what has been really central for performers and also for fans who really enjoy the cultural movement is that there is that rapport of kind of communal understanding, and fans and stars often exchanging their positionality and truly kind of coming together as one community. I mean, despite the hyper-commercialization, that aspect of whom cannot be denied.
No, I'd agree with that. And I think you navigate the kind of potential dangers of essentialization very well and make clear that what you're, the point you're making is based on very sound evidence. And without wishing to sort of put too fine a point on it, living in Japan now, I think a relative absence of hung is something I somewhat miss, but that's, I guess, that's my own issue there. That's great. Well, I think that's given us a pretty good picture of some of the key points that the book will be addressing throughout. So we'll move forward perhaps into the chapters themselves from the introduction. And you kind of structure it according to various media platforms, broadly speaking, from TV through social media, music videos and live shows. Although you also are clear to careful to point out that it's fairly futile trying to draw rigid lines between these different forms. To kind of lead us into this very complex mediatized world, your sort of historical introduction, I think, gives a really super interesting perspective on what the conditions were that allowed for K-pop to emerge. Could you say something about how how you see it coming about? And I'd be particularly interested, one of the absolute best bits for the whole book, I thought, was your theorization of the Teletubbies generation. So could you perhaps bring in some of that in your sort of historicizing little account here?
Sure. So, many scholars, including myself, point to mid-1990s as the first kind of beginning of K-pop as we know it. I mean, narrowly defined as, teenage idol music. And that was mid-1990s was an interesting period in many regards. I mean, first, in terms of Korean politics, we have a civilian government which is looking into globalization as its major policy. Travel ban on South Korean citizens is lifted, so South Koreans are now able to travel to places, as opposed to the previous generation who needed to receive permits. So they are truly kind of cruising around the globe, and that trend is starting in mid-90s. Young college students in the 90s are spending more time in their self-grooming and enjoyment as opposed to the previous generation of college students who were the main players of South Korea's democracy movement. So these social shifts are also merging with tidal shifts in media consumption. Mid-90s, yes, I mean, you have J-pop as one of the kind of key player in Korean music industry, as well as in Asia, where people used to kind of consume music through their, individual cassette player, right? But then that generation of kind of, Walkman owners are soon to be kind of replaced by MP3 music consumers. And I think this is really important for K-pop's emergence because, Korean musicians used to kind of earn income from sales, by selling their CDs and cassette tapes and LP. But when music suddenly became free online, suddenly their kind of reliable source of income disappeared almost overnight because everything was downloadable and free. So this really pushed Korean musicians to look elsewhere. And this is when K-pop turns its eye to the world stage. I mean, out of desperation. And this is where also K-pop and J-pop differ significantly because, Japan is a second largest music industry. And the copyrights for artists are relatively well protected. So, I mean, J-pop artists didn't have to do this, but K-pop artists really had to look for alternative ways to having a career. And they had no other choice but to look beyond Korea. And this is also the time when cable TV was introduced to Korea. Mid-90s, Korean cable network started to bring MTV to Korean spectators. And merging with the globalization movement, I mean, Korean consumers were now being introduced to Madonna, Michael Jackson, and all other kind of visually driven performances. So all of these came together. And on top of everything, I guess, you know, today's K-pop fans who were just infants and toddlers in mid-90s, where all these seismic changes were happening, were also regular viewers of Teletubbies. And Teletubby programming was introduced to cable viewers in Korea. And I myself watched a lot of it because I was babysitting my nieces who were infants and toddlers back then in mid-90s and late 90s. And looking back, I think Teletubbies played some interesting role in grooming today's K-pop consumers and perhaps YouTube generation in a broad sense. Because, you know, the Teletubbies' bodies, if you look at them, they're interesting media receptacles. You know, they have this embedded screen. Just like Generation Z would love to have this screen as part of the extension of their bodies, you know. I mean, sometimes I take away cell phones from my students because I cannot have a normal class because they're so distracted and they have withdrawal syndrome. And Teletubbies have this screen embedded in them. And also the repeated viewing that Teletubbies encourage is, I think, foreshadowing the rise of kind of, you know, binge watching and media regurgitation that's so endemic to reaction videos and how repeatedly we consume K-pop contents as well as some, you know, viral media contents.
Yeah, no, I thought was incredibly compelling. I mean, I on some level, obviously, there's a certain amount of, I don't know, kind of eye rolling that you might do about being reminded of the kind of again, Teletubbies refrain is, you know, maybe not something I necessarily welcome being reminded of on a day-to-day basis, but it, as an insight into how that kind of is a precursor, a kind of predictor to the you know, when you finished watching a YouTube video, there's the little round arrow that invites you to just watch it again, exactly the same thing again. And you kind of give a bigger picture there, really weaving in the technological and the political in a sense by discussing how Korea, obviously, over this same period that you're sort of describing here, was also becoming the key center for smartphone production, Samsung in particular, but also LG and other major mobile technology firms, and how that became kind of embedded in this commercialized pop world, which I think is tremendous lens onto understanding not just K-pop as a form, but also modern Korean history in a sense. But we'll move on perhaps, because although you give a clear picture of all of this media, the social media and the kind of very high tech, the place of that within the K-pop world, you point out that TV is still pretty important, oddly enough, even though so much is online. And so in chapter two, you discuss a couple of live TV shows or TV shows in particular, Music Core and After School Club, these two South Korean TV programs. What is it that makes TV still have a role within the K-pop world?
So I would say that TV was a really important medium for new idols to introduce themselves to public, especially would-be fandom, because these top of the chart TV shows usually have very low ratings. But, you know, the main spectator group is teenage fans of K-pop, usually female fans. And they were seen as a conduit through which brand new idols can finally debut and start kind of publicizing themselves. So the book deals with one of those shows, Music Core, produced by NBC. But I would say that that rule has really changed since BTS kind of broke out into the world stage. So, you know, academic publishing really lags behind in its speed, and it cannot fully address the rapidly changing real-time reality. And if I can go back, I really want to add another chapter dealing with the kind of new model of idol production and their career, mainly encapsulated in BTS, who is the leading idol of today. So prior to BTS, yes, all the K-pop entertainment companies had to work with terrestrial or cable network to debut their idols. Otherwise, it's really hard to promote them to broad audience. But BTS was really special in a sense that they come from a rather minor production company at the time of their debut. And they decide to circumvent the TV network channels and just target directly their global fandoms through social media. So BTS provides a counterexample to some of the arguments made in the book. So if I could go back, I would love to add a chapter on BTS. But, you know, one just to kind of focus on what the book says, one interesting thing about these TV shows is that they're not just consumed on TV networks. I mean, they have a second life, which is perhaps more interesting, meaning that, you know, those TV shows are produced with YouTube in mind. So they enjoy actually much broader circulation outside of TV networks when they become YouTube files and can be regurgitated over and over again. So I think if anything important can be emphasized in that chapter, I think it's really the kind of this transmedial network of how TV and online space are so intertwined together.
Right, right. And you illustrate how it not only does the TV end up going online, but then the online comes onto TV too through some of these live engagement shows and sort of phone-in shows where fans are encouraged to call in and speak to their idols. And there are these there are outbursts of this hung feeling on over the phone or over video link. And you describe the kind of role reversal which can occur when fans are showing the artists their own performances of their songs, and really, yeah, I guess illustrate very well this real sort of soup of blurred lines of performer and spectator and different media presentations, and I think we see the same kind of some of the same sorts of trends in music videos themselves, which is the subject of your next chapter. And again, you take a couple of specific cases: a video by Tetiso, which is a subgroup of Girls' Generation, right? And then also a video by G-Dragon. Could you say something about how these music videos kind of demonstrate the idea of liveness, how people seek to create liveness within music videos, and how they kind of blur performance genres and so on in the music videos that are produced?
Yes, so music videos are so crucial for K-pop to show their idols and illustrate what it is about to global audience, because most K-pop fans cannot go to live shows, especially those living in remote areas. I mean, outside of the normal K-pop's, you know, live tour circuits. So in order to compensate for the lack of live interaction, meaning real-time co-presence of performers and fans in the same space. Some music videos have devised very clever kind of format to simulate the live interaction through their music videos. And my case studies really are good examples to illustrate that. So the first case study, Tethys's Twinkle, taps into the format of Broadway-style musicals. Even the screen is framed by this crimson curtain parting to reveal the proscenium stage. And the musical tone and the cultural reference it makes all kind of point to the live singers interacting with fans. So you have like embedded audience, and also musical theater makes reference to the Supremes and Motown culture, where these like vivid presence of live voice played such a role in popularizing the genre. So I thought that was a really interesting way of making up for the lack of actual live interaction for the vast majority of fans. And G-Dragon's music video, Who You, is another kind of extension of the same idea, but this time G-Dragon uses kind of live performance and fan meeting format to create his music video. So from the very inception, fans played a huge role in kind of creating the fabric of the music video, meaning that they came to the actual shooting site of G-Dragon's music video, and they also used their cell phones to shoot G-Dragon's music kind of performance, and some of those fan videos made into the actual final cut of music video. So there is like this real interaction between the performer and the fans to kind of simulate the live performance and fan meetings that most music video consumers cannot have access to.
And those, I think this is where some of your expertise in performance art and in the broader picture of how cultural production and performance works really come to the fore, and this dissection of the sort of play of genres and the play of historical reference and allusions to other forms of performance art in these videos, it really contextualizes, and I think it doesn't make any less fun fascinating visual spectacles, so it's very important, I think, background to understanding what this kind of key term of liveness and what means, and how people are trying to produce liveness within potentially not fully live performances and displays of the music. So this, I think, applies to the next chapter, where you explore hot use of holograms in live shows and also in some of these kind of centres that you can visit, K-Live and SM Town. I hadn't realised actually that hologram technology in particular was a major government initiative of the Park Geun-hye era, recently ended, last president before now. But could you say a bit more about the place that holograms have and how they're being used in K-pop today?
Yes, so this is where Korea, as in K-pop, really comes into play. Holograms are never sufficient substitute for live performers that fans desperately want to see. I mean, a lot of fans already think that K-pop overall is already so mediatized, right? Because, I mean, usually we encounter K-pop in cyberspace, TV. But to have a live theater format where real audience members are invited into auditorium to be treated to this kind of hollow image of a performer is just not working. That's the conclusion of that chapter on hologram. But, because why would you see a mediatized image of already highly mediatized star? It just cannot make up for the real aura of a real human being. And that chapter was kind of more inspired by what Korean government was trying to do with K-pop industry. due to this massively failed creative economy policy that was touted by Park Geun-hye administration, this K-pop industry and Korean state had this kind of rather skeptical marriage with each other that kind of ended in failure. For the reasons that I already described, that why would you go pay for a live theater ticket to see a mediatized image of a mediatized performer? But I think it was somewhat of a top-down movement from the Korean government to really use K-pop's global visibility to advance its hologram projects. So, you know, you can really see that kind of unsettling relationship between Korean state and K-pop industry, and that marriage cannot be, you know, always a perfect one.
Right, right. In chapter five, the sort of final full chapter, you provide a pretty good antidote to that by bringing us right back into live shows and the concerts, that many of which you attended yourself. Is the marriage there between government initiative and K-pop performance, does it work any better in the context of some of these live shows and bigger events like KCON, these kind of bigger conventions that involve K-pop stars and government players? Is that a happier union between government initiative and artistic production?
In a way, yes, because at least those pop conventions or live concerts feature real stars, and that makes up for everything. Although fans are there not to really understand what Korean government's projects are. I mean, they are interested in Korea and Korean culture in general, but it is always channeled through what they love and whom they love, which are K-pop stars and K-pop music. So, you know, the marriage between the state and K-pop industry is no more successful than in hologram shows that I described. I mean, I've witnessed many instances where fans were just bored and held, you know, captive audience when they had to be treated to all these government-led initiatives to propagate Korean culture in a top-down manner. But fans kind of tolerate that just because at the end of the tunnel, they will have a live interaction with the stars. And right. I've seen many instances where Korean government really held these global K-pop fandoms at their hostage, you know, and kind of showing the bait, which is the K-pop idol at the end of the tunnel, and, you know, signed a treaty between governments or introduce their initiatives. So, yeah, I mean, you know what? K-pop has to come from bottom up. It can never be a successful project top down.
I see. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned one, actually this is in the conclusion, but one quite sort of amusing slash tragic incident where there's a lot of hype being generated for some particular K-pop stars, and then a quick announcement that Park Geun-hye herself is in the house, and the camera quickly pans to her, and the cheering doesn't have time to die down when people sort of find themselves inadvertently cheering for, you know, obviously a president that ultimately proved to be extremely unpopular. I think that's a really interesting interesting exploration of how the kind of the bait is used there. And I guess as we sort of come towards the end, could you just give us a bit of a picture of your own role at some of these conventions and how you were positioned in relation to the events that occur, and maybe just describe a bit more what kinds of things are happening at these conventions.
Oh, these conventions have grown so much bigger in just past 5 years. And, you know, being a resident of LA, I have privilege of attending annual K-pop convention, KCON, that's organized by CJENM. And I am a very skeptical person. I mean, as a critical professor, researcher, you have to be skeptical. You have to question, and you have to put a lot of things under microscopic scrutiny to really make sure that you're making a persuasive argument. And I am, you know, in many cases, very skeptical of this affective relationship that's spun between fans and idols. And I sometimes feel sorry for fans who might be manipulated by these business plans and all that. But having said that, when I go to the KCON, I truly come to realization that it's perhaps not about idols or industry or business that's involved, but it's really about the community that is spontaneously growing and fostered, perhaps using K-pop or K-pop idols as just intermediary to build those communities. So, you know, I go to see many idols and their acts, but what I end up coming back home is how passionate the fans are. And, you know, in that sense, I think idol or icon to describe K-pop performers might be an appropriate expression, because what they do is to mitigate and channel those connections that didn't exist before. So K-pop perhaps is a bridge building place for different subjects who feel unconnected and fragmented to come together as some kind of genuine community. So, you know, that's all I can say. It is truly astonishing, and it could be enigmatic and paradoxical, but the true love that exists in K-pop community is there.
No, I think that's it's a very poignant kind of conclusion that you come to overall, because as you describe these conventions, which involve both, of course, very obvious government participation, but also big business. And it's easy to see fans just as you say, skeptically, just as subjects to overwhelming kind of neoliberal and state dominated logics and regimes. But I think your reflections there on youth and on passion and on the kind of search for meaning and connection and the sincerity with which many people feel those things in relation to this wider K-pop sphere. It's very evocative and I think an important balance to the book as a whole. So I would urge listeners to go out and read the whole thing, because it has a great deal more to say on all these subjects. But Sukyoung, I've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I'd like to thank you very much. But before we do close out, I'd just ask you, what is it you're up to now? I mean, how has your career continued to follow the K-pop wave, or are you departing in other directions? What kind of projects do you have on the go currently?
Since completing K-pop Live, I've written a few more articles on K-pop industry that I couldn't quite address in the book, which includes the racial dynamics of K-pop performers and the implications of global fandom. Another article deals with the intersections of K-pop and fashion industry and fashion practices, and how K-pop not only becomes an online runway, but also it is seen as something that has the self-reflective moment to think about fast fashion industry recycling and the ethical dimensions of consumption. So I analyzed BTS's music video Spring Day and G-Dragon's Crooked, which feature really interesting messages about clothing and fashion and fast industry.
Great. Well, it's good that BTS have made it into your written output then, so that you kind of provide some updates to the latest developments. As you mentioned, they weren't so present in the book. But that's great. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Sukyoung, for agreeing to appear on the show today. It was really fantastic talking to you about this.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We'll speak to you next time. Goodbye.